Sure.
Has anybody heard from Mayor Brewer?
Are we ready?
You pulled into the parking lot.
The House Committee on Revenue will come to order. We're open a public hearing on House Bill 3058, and we have a very distinguished first panel. Gentlemen and lady, good morning.
Good morning.
You want to begin?
Would you like staff to give us a quick summary of the bill? You want to do that, and then we'll let them go.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3058 changes the corporation minimum tax for corporations that are cooperatives, and in the bill, it just links to the IRC. Section 1381 defined that definition. And inside your packet, you'll find the IRC, and then embedded within the IRC 1381, there's a reference to organizations exempt from tax under Section 521. So you also have that IRC. So just to provide the context for the cooperatives that are under review in the bill, and it would change their minimum tax from the current sliding scale of 150 to 100,000 to the same as S corporations and the smallest C corporations, a flat $150.
Yes, sir.
Good morning, members of the committee, Co-Chair Barnhart and Co-Chair Berger. Thank you for hearing this bill, and thank you for the opportunity to come and before you. I'm State Representative Bob Jensen from House District 58. Which at least at one time was given credit for being the largest producer of wheat in the state, and which Marion County has the reputation of being the largest agricultural producer in the state. However, Umatilla County has the distinction of being the largest food producer in the state. So no disrespect to the folks in the floral industries and so forth, but we are about feeding the people of the world. Thus, at one time when I had how to be referred to on the House floor, I wanted to be referred to as the representative from the land of loaves and fishes. Loaves the wheat and smolt the fishes. I think we have some folks from the industry that will be here testifying today. And I know that the three of us, if we all talk as long as I've already talked, are going to use more time than you want us to use. So I'll turn to my right and let the representative proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. and Madam Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, Representative Dave Hunt from Clackamas County, which actually vies neck and neck with Marion County for being the top agricultural producer. But it is true that eating nursery stock and Christmas trees is not very good eating. This bill before you, House Bill 3058, will erase for what some of us was a painful memory of House Bill 3058 from the 2009 session, which was related to linear projects. That bill may have a memory trigger for you. But this bill really goes back and fixes an issue that has been there laying dormant in state statute since 2003 when we switched over to the single sales factor. There was something embedded in that definition of single sales factor, and I voted for it, several of you did, the whole goal, as you'll recall, of single sales factor was trying to shift us to a place where businesses that export get favorable tax treatment under the Oregon Tax Code. And so if you are Intel or Nike and you are marketing your product out of state, in many cases out of the country, you only pay based on your Oregon sales. I think many of us understood that as being broadly applicable. But when you look at wheat growers, and you may hear a few other impacts today as well in the agricultural sector, That's not the way it's playing out. Even though 80 or 90% of Oregon wheat is exported around the world, in many cases that wheat is being taxed as though it's being sold to Oregonians because it's being sold, and I put sold in quotations, sold to an Oregon co-op, an Oregon-based co-op, taxed at that point. And then 80 or 90% of it is being sold to customers around the world. So this would fix that by saying if it is a co-op under that definition, that it would be treated as though it's going for its ultimate destination. It would not be taxed again at that point. So I actually think this is largely a technical fix. I'll be very interested in seeing when we get the full revenue forecast, or excuse me, the full revenue statement back on this, what the actual impacts are. Hopefully it's relatively modest. And look forward to working with you all, my colleagues here, as Representative Smith and Senator Nelson, to find ways to pay for that if that cost is more egregious than I hope it will be. Appreciate your consideration.
And thank you, Co-Chair Barnhart and Co-Chair Almost Grandma Berger, and committee members. If she leaks out of here, you'll know why. Yeah. For the record, Deborah Boone, I represent House District 32, which doesn't have a lot of wheat in it, but I might have a little in the Washington County sector. But I do have a connection, as I have a small wheat farm in North Dakota, and my wheat passes through Oregon's waters and roads on its way to export out into the ocean, which is in my district, too. And I'm here to provide just general support for this. I believe it's a fairness issue, too, and in the fact that my good colleague from Happy Valley is not here, he would tell you that if you need revenue, there is lots of revenue in Oregon in the form of trees in our forests. So that I had to do that for him because I owe him. But this is a good bill. This is makes the, as Representative Hunt explained about the 2003 vote, it makes it fairer, and I support it.
Thank you. And before we go on, I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2565, along with the bill we're already discussing. And I don't know whether the three of you want to comment on the differences between these two bills or not, but it's essentially on the same topic with a slightly different method for accomplishing the same end. Is that a fair summary? Okay. Any questions for our distinguished colleagues? Representative Berger.
It's simply a comment to the good representative from the land of loaves and fishes. The fact of the matter is that in the downturn of the housing boom, there's not so much of a call for nursery stock, and we're growing a lot of wheat now here in the valley, I understand. So I'm joining you in feeding the nations.
Mr. Chair and Co-Chair Berger, I certainly would appreciate that, but there are some other factors that are taking place mostly in Chicago, I think, where the price of wheat has and cereal grains has taken a significant increase that has encouraged more production.
I understand.
In my area of the country, too. So.
I understand.
Yes. That is really an important point. I don't know that it has much to do with either of these bills, but we are growing more and more grains and beans and things of that kind in the valley, in the Willamette Valley, for local consumption. And while you get a good price in other parts of the world, I think the local production gets an even better price at the farmer's market, at least right now. Anything else? Yes, Representative Eric Brewer.
Thank you, Chair. I have a question. I have a technical question on both proposals 2565 and 3058, and I'm not sure who. Do we have other people coming to speak? I'm not sure who's
yes.
the most appropriate person to ask it.
We do. We have a number of people. The,
okay.
The Ag Council and several others.
Okay, I'll hold my question.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you very much. We very much appreciate your introduction to this bill this morning. Representative Jensen?
Just to say thank you very much for hearing these bills. We appreciate your thought and deliberation, and we look forward to your results when we get to talk about them again. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Shall we hear from John McCulley, David Brook, and Daryl Knox? Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chair, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. I'm John McCulley. I'm here representing the Agriculture Cooperative Council of Oregon. Our organization works on behalf of various kinds of cooperatives in the state, fruit, vegetable, nut cooperatives, dairy cooperatives, supply cooperatives, credit cooperatives. There's quite a variety of cooperatives in the state. And we're here today in support of House Bill 2565. We'd also support House Bill 3058. So we're very grateful that you're evaluating the situation that's arisen as a result of ballot measure 67 and its impact on cooperatives, and thank you for having the hearing today. One of the main issues that we have, of course, is the way that cooperatives are structured and do business. Cooperatives are, by principle, non-profit organizations. They are required to pass whatever income they receive back to the members who are the owners of the cooperative. I've put a small diagram on my testimony to describe that, and I could throw it on a screen, but I think we could probably just go ahead and look at it on the paper so you could see how the funds that revolve in the cooperative are handled. And where you see the box co-op member delivers a product to the cooperative, is paid for that, and that sale to the co-op results in a taxable event. The co-op will then process and market that product and sell it to a customer, hopefully realizing a profit from that. Under Measure 67, that sale from the co-op to a customer results in the gross receipts tax being applied to those dollars. Those dollars then, as a result, with the net income arriving from that sale to the customer, are passed back through the co-op to the member. And the member, again, would pay a tax on that net income going back to the, in this case, the farmer owner of the co-op. We believe that is not the appropriate way to do the tax, that it does indeed result in the same revenue being taxed twice. There are about 40 agriculture cooperatives in the state. They, as I mentioned in my opening, are a wide variety of different kinds of companies. In addition, I believe there are about a dozen grocery cooperatives and a handful of other businesses operating as co-ops. I'm just trying to give you an idea of the universe that we're talking about in this legislation. Those co-ops are included under the definition of Section 1381, and so my estimate is about 70 cooperatives who are going to be most affected by the legislation you have before you. I also looked at how other states that have a gross receipts tax treat cooperatives. Texas and Ohio both provide a blanket exemption so that any cooperative organized under their cooperative statutes in Texas and Ohio are exempt from their gross receipts tax. They're called by different names, but in essence a gross receipts tax. Michigan, the other state, takes an approach similar to what we're proposing in House Bill 2565 and in House Bill 3058, in that they reference IRS Section 1381. So based on the fact that cooperatives are not-for-profit enterprises that pass their profits back to their members, the fact that House Bill 2565 and 3058 are consistent with how other states that have gross receipts tax tax cooperatives. We believe that this is a good policy for the state of Oregon to adopt, and we urge your approval of House Bill 2565. I've also attached to my testimony a letter from Tillamook County Creamery Association, also supporting the legislation. And I have with me Dave Buck and Daryl Knox, who are accountants who work with cooperatives, and they are here to answer technical questions that you may have about the legislation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Did they want to be heard now or in response to questions?
Do you have anything to say?
Response to questions, and then maybe we'll add at the end if we can help out.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Wand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What type of gross range of gross revenues are we talking about for a garden variety co-op?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wand, I don't know if we can classify garden variety because there is such a diversity in the state. We have some fairly large companies that are cooperatives in this area, Nortac Foods, Wilco Farmers, Pendleton Grain Growers. They would all have, I'm guessing, gross receipts in excess of $100 million. Most of that business, of course, is done with their members. And they would continue to pay a tax on business done with non-members. So supply cooperatives who would tend to do a lot of business with non-members may not receive any, quote, relief or benefit from this legislation because their tax on net income would be higher than the gross receipts tax. So it's really difficult to categorize where they fall.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Eric Brewer. Then you get to your technical questions.
I think you may be able to answer my technical question. Both of the House bills before us talk about a cooperative organization described in Section 1381 of the Internal Revenue Code, and that includes Section 521, which is the Farmers Ag, the co-ops that we've mostly been hearing about, but it also mentions and any corporation operating on a cooperative basis, and then it has some exceptions to that definition. Can you tell me, can you give me a concrete example in Oregon of what those other types of corporations are, and then I'd like to investigate what that impact is, since those seem to be outside of the ag co-ops.
Yes.
One of the types, I think, John, David Buck with AKT.
Thank you.
One of the types I think that John mentioned a moment ago, for instance, a grocery cooperative. If you look at 1381, Section 1381, it's the umbrella that covers virtually all co-ops, including these 521 farmers, certain types of farmers co-ops. But that umbrella would include any organization that operates as a co-op, a grocery co-op, that where they're just buying and selling product, but they're not growing it themselves, would be an example of one type of a co-op that this would fall under. Other type of marketing and purchasing co-ops where organizations are put together simply to bring the group together for the buying power, I guess. And this might be a good time to mention as well. I held off when I had the option earlier, but I wanted to reiterate what John said earlier, and that is that the baseline issue here to us is that a cooperative is, by law, operates at cost. There's no profit motive, and the example that John used of the cash flow through a cooperative, really, it's just an extension. It's more akin to a partnership. It's just an extension of this group of farmers who came together that want to either market their products or purchase products. And at the end of the day, if the cooperative does have any, we use the term profit sum, but it's really not profit. If they have any excess cash, they have to, by law, distribute that back to the members, and those members pay tax on it. So at the end of the day, it's really a neutral, a cash neutral, a profit neutral entity. And I think that's the baseline for why this gross receipts tax in regards to cooperative operations seems very unfair.
Okay.
Thank you.
Other questions? I have one, I think, that's related to the issue of In both of these bills, we have two different sections that refer to co-ops. In 2565, The language is described in Section 1381 of the Internal Revenue Code, comma, Oregon sales does not include sales representing business done with or for members of the cooperative organization. Now, that language would appear to include all these agricultural co-ops we've been talking about, but exclude the ones that you were mentioning where most of their business is done with non-members. Is that the way you read it, too, or have I misunderstood it?
Mr. Chair, it would include those businesses that, those cooperatives that do business with non-members, but that non-member business would still be subject to taxation. What we're talking about here is the portion of that cooperative's business that is done with members.
Now, the other bill has similar language. It says, Oregon sales does not include patronage dividends or transactions with cooperative members. And that's the issue that you were getting at, isn't it? I think, where transactions with members wouldn't be included. And when the surplus is divvied up at the end of the year and returned to members, I assume that's the patronage dividend that we're talking about.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to let Mr. Buck comment on why the language is different in the two bills, because we did, in initial drafts of our House Bill 2565, looked at that language and recommended the language that you see in House Bill 2565. So I'll let Mr. Buck comment on why we chose to go the direction we did.
So you like 2565 better than 3058, and now you're going to tell me what the differences are.
Yeah. Correct.
Yes. Thank you. Please.
Mr. Chair, you're very observant. I think what you described as being a patronage dividend a moment ago is correct, but we feel that the issue and the difference between these two bills and our feelings that 2565 is more accurate and on point is because we are dealing with the Oregon minimum tax is driven by gross sales, and what we were trying to identify in 2565 was that the sales that the co-op has that were either marketing the products for the members or marketing the supplies that they have to that the co-op is receiving for them, that those sales are the ones that we're trying to identify and pull out of the equation. In House Bill 3058, when they speak to patronage dividends. Patronage dividends really aren't a sales number. They're, as you mentioned a moment ago, they're a net at the end that's divvied up. And we felt that that was not really on point, even though conceptually I think we all know what 3058 was trying to do. We felt that the definition for what needs to be considered wasn't accurate. I don't know if
I do understand. The fact that you may have a surplus, which is a relatively, in these co-ops, that would be a very small percentage of the actual sales.
That's correct.
And that doesn't help you in terms of dealing with the tax based on your total Oregon sales.
That's right. We felt it wasn't on point at all. I think the concept that all those who wrote both bills, the concept was still driven at eliminating the gross sales tax on cooperative activity. And we felt that under 2565, by identifying cooperative activity to mean sales done in a cooperative fashion with or for patrons, and those sales that ultimately, if there is a net profit at the end of the day, are divvied back to the members, that all those sales should be eliminated in determining whether or not we have to pay this gross receipts tax.
All right. And so let me follow the line along. Now, there apparently are some co-ops that do a very large percentage of their business with non-members. How does this section affect those co-ops, or does it? Are they still Section 1381 co-ops or something else?
No, Mr.
And
Chair.
And if they are, how would this section about sales representing business done with or for members of the cooperative organization, what effect would that have on those kinds of businesses?
In many co-ops, they have both activities going on. They're doing business with or for patrons, member patrons, and doing business with you or I who pull in to use their services. So anything that's non-member related, that activity, we're not suggesting any changes. That is typically taxed as any other corporation in Oregon would be taxed. and that would continue to be the case. So those would not fall under this exemption and come to a point where they'd no longer pay tax on that where they were in the past. Those will still be taxed and identified as a separate activity.
Let me follow the line along a little bit. Are the profits or the surplus, whatever you call it, from that activity also passed back to the cooperative members?
No, it's not.
It's not. And how is that handled then?
That's simply retained in the company, and it is subject to the same taxation that any for-profit corporation goes through. So they would pay tax at the corporate level just like any other corporation.
Yeah, and we have another.
Daryl Knox with AKT. Now, it is ultimately for the benefit of the members.
Sure.
And they, if the entity were to liquidate, of course, it would then be for the benefit of the members. But originally, it is not allocated to those members for their share of that taxable income in that year.
In the same sense as any shareholder of any business corporation would benefit from the profits the corporation makes, even if it doesn't distribute the money that year.
Correct.
Thank you. And then I want to turn the page over and look at the other provision that's being changed on line 8 and 9 of the bill, 2565, and that says, if a corporation is an S corporation, the old language, or a cooperative organization described in section 1381 of the Internal Revenue Code, the new language, the minimum tax is $150. Now, I think I understand how that works with the co-ops that do almost all of their business with members. As the wheat co-op that we talked about in February of last year, for example. How would that apply to the ones we have just been discussing where some of their business is with members and a substantial piece is with non-members, and those profits are dealt with in a different way in terms of the accounting and the way the money is handled? If I understand this provision, that corporation would pay only $150 regardless of the income that it made, not from members or not related to members. Have I got that right, or have I missed that?
I'm not sure that was the intent, Mr. Chair. I think the intent of it was that they would pay if they had no profits, they'd at least pay the minimum tax. But if they had profits, they would pay on the same corporate tax rate schedule that any other corporation in the state of Oregon would pay. So if they made $100,000, they'd pay $6,600, give or take, whatever the corporate tax rate on that profit is with those non-patrons. So, no, it was not intended to be a flat $150 on that business done by the co-op.
And I think that's a correct characterization because this section refers to the minimum tax, not to the income tax.
Right. That's correct.
And, of course, the co-ops that do all their business with members don't have any income because they distribute it. So they don't pay anyway. But is there ever a situation in which a corporation, I guess there wouldn't be, would there? If they have no profits from work they do with non-members, then they would automatically fall into this category of taxation, wouldn't they? Representative Air Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually, as you bring that up, concur about a concern with that, and it's not jumping out at me. In this language, the S-Corp's minimum tax is $150, but to the extent that they generate C-Corp tax, they're subject to the higher gross receipts, and S-Corps can actually generate C-Corp income, then they're subject to this minimum tax. And I'm not quite sure the ORS statute that refers the S-Corp back to the C-Corp tax in Measure 67 that was passed. But the co-op, we need to make sure that the co-op language that could throw back the sales to non-members is actually included in here. Because I do agree that there's a potentially a technical hole here for the non-member sales.
Okay. Thank you. Can we get LC to look at this issue for us and come back with an answer?
Yes.
It may be that we have to tighten up the language on the second page. I don't know, of the bill. And if you want to look into it further, please do. The issue, of course, at this point is not the policy, but getting the bill right. We've had enough experience with that issue lately that I get very gun-shy about not doing it correctly in the first place.
We'll follow up on that as well, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions, thoughts about these two bills? I actually have one more person to be heard. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. It's very helpful to get this information. And I'm going to mess up this name, I think. It looks like Darren Paget, perhaps?
Paget.
Paget. Thank you, sir.
How are you doing today?
Good morning.
Co-Chair Berger, Co-Chair Barnhart, thank you very much for your time. My name is Darren Paget. I'm the immediate past president of the Oregon Wheat Growers League. I live in a little town called Grass Valley in Sherman County. I'm a member of Mid-Columbia Producers and Morrill County Grain Growers, both of which are a very high-volume, low-margin business. So this is very important to us. I have served on co-op boards for many years, chaired them. Tried to learn the difference between qualified and non-qualified patronage, and this is a real tough area, so I appreciate you taking this on. The Oregon Wheat Growers League is a nonprofit trade organization representing over 4,000 wheat growers in the state of Oregon. The OWGL thanks you for the opportunity to testify in favor of House Bill 3058. Wheat is an important agricultural product in Oregon, ranking sixth in terms of value based on price and production. Over 85% of the grain grown in Oregon is exported primarily overseas through the commercial export facilities located at the Port of Portland with destinations primarily to the Pacific Rim. The practice of consolidating and marketing this product through cooperatives is a long-standing business practice in the wheat industry. The single sales factor adopted by the legislature in 2003 disadvantaged the co-op structure favored by the agricultural community for a number of commodities. For wheat, which is primarily grown for export, the disadvantage is significant. The disadvantage was exacerbated by the passage of Measure 67, which raised the corporate minimum. Wheat producers, through the co-op, are being taxed for products destined for markets outside of Oregon. The single sales factor was designed to protect industries exporting out of Oregon, but the practice of consolidating this product for sale was not addressed correctly in the 2003 legislation. House Bill 3058 seeks to remedy this problem and place the wheat industry on equal footing with other Oregon industries exporting outside of Oregon. It will exempt member transactions and patronage dividends from the definition of Oregon sales when calculating the Oregon taxable income. For this reason, the Oregon Wheat Growers League requests your support of House Bill 3058. Thank you very much. Questions for me?
Thank you. Go to the back. Questions?
Thank you very much.
Does this bill fix the error that you think was made in 2003, or does it simply deal with the minimum tax, or do you know?
I'm not well-versed enough to know the in-depth of I know the results of 67 has been an additional, for Mid-Columbia producers, have been $59,000 in additional tax this year. It's not unusual to have $50 to $100 million in gross sales and net $400,000 at the end of the day. So anything extra can be very significant to us.
Thank you.
I was going to say, I can confirm whether it fixes it, but the minimum tax does tie to the definition of sales. So that's
for the purpose of the corporate excise and income tax?
Right. When the single sales factor was put in place, the definition of Oregon sales and all of everything that went with it was in place. And the minimum tax just said the definition of Oregon sales is that which is used for apportionment.
So when, as we, yes, Representative Berger.
So, Chris, what you're saying is by changing to this, tying to this federal statute, it would solve the 2003 problem of the wheat sitting, being an Oregon sale as it's sitting on the dock.
I need to confirm that.
Yes.
Yeah, but that would be, I mean, that's a different issue than the one that the other panel raised. We'll find out.
Okay. Yeah.
If I understand it correctly, what you do is, the way in which you handle your books is such that all your sales become Oregon sales, even though even though the wheat is being exported.
It changes hand two times.
Yes.
Before it goes out the door.
Right, and so even though the wheat is being exported to Asia or somewhere, it's still an Oregon sale because of the way the books are handled.
Yes, if I sell my grain, I get a check, in my case, from Mid-Columbia Producers, then Mid-Columbia Producers would go to Cargill, Louis Dreyfus, Coama Export, one of those. They get a check from them, and the exporters are the ones that you know, ultimately it goes out the door, but that's just the way our system works, and it's set up very well and is very efficient with our river system and everything. It's great. And Port of Portland, you know, that's 40% of the grains of the grain in the nation goes through that port. It's very significant.
Yes.
So it's a big deal, and I mean everybody's kind of getting nailed along the way on this a little bit.
We have ships that come up river, floating high, and go down river, floating low.
And with the channel deepening that Representative Hunt was behind, it just added another 10% to the net of those ships going down the river, which makes us more competitive with the world markets.
Yeah, and the tax issue, if just to finish the thought, mm-hmm. the tax issue for you is a very small fraction of the price, but the price differential between you and other producers sometimes gets pretty small, doesn't it?
And
therefore, the tax is a competitive issue.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you mean other producers, you mean my fellow
other parts of the country, other parts of the world.
Yes.
Australia and other
absolutely.
Places. Yeah.
Right now, with prices up, it's all over the board as to where your sales are going to come from. The buyers are very selective right now, and they're very price sensitive, just like you going to the gas pump and buying it a cheap penny cheaper across the road. It can hit us just as easily.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you, sir. Appreciate
you
your testimony this morning very much.
Appreciate it.
Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on these two bills, 2565 and 3058? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing on those two bills, and we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2075.
Pretty simple. Yeah, that's good.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2075 establishes alternative methods for telecommunications provider to satisfy the requirement to collect and remit tax on customers' access to 911 emergency reporting on the 911 emergency reporting system from prepaid telecommunications service customers.
Thank you. We have quite a list this morning, and I'm going to start with General Caldwell, if he's here. Here he comes. Is General Caldwell here?
I am, yes, sir.
Oh, there he is. And anyone else you want to bring, sir?
Pick anybody you want.
Well, okay. Thank you. You're going to describe the problem for us, I trust.
Yes, sir.
Yes, thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, co-chairs, Barnhart and Berger. For the record, my name is Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department and the Interim Director of the Office of Emergency Management. House Bill 2075 was crafted by our agency with the goal in mind of maintaining the equity of taxation in the 911 excise tax on all instruments capable of reaching 911 for emergency services in Oregon. The current statute states, it's 403.200, imposition of tax rate, and I'm quoting, there is imposed on each paying retailer subscriber who has telecommunication service with access to 911 emergency reporting system a tax equal to 75 cents per month. It goes on further in the law to say, for cellular, wireless, or other radio common carriers, the tax applies on a per-instrument basis, and only if subscribers place a primary use as defined and determined under 4th U.S. Code 116 to 126 is within this state. The 911 tax was initiated to provide for supporting the emergency response system to the citizens and visitors of Oregon. The use and distributions of these taxes is vital to these 911 centers or public service answering points to deliver critical life safety services. The distribution of the tax is defined in statute is 60.5% to the PSAPs, 35% maintained by the Office of Emergency Management to maintain the equipment and upgrade for future technologies like next generation, and the remaining 4.5% of the tax for administration, Office of Emergency Management, and Department of Revenue. Although the distribution is 60.5%, these amounts actually only support about 25 to 30% of the total cost of providing for the typical 911 center or PSAP. The remaining costs associated with this function and the dispatch of first responders is covered by local government and their local tax base. The 35% equipment replacement account that OEM manages pays to maintain the infrastructure backbone of the statewide system. It is mainly payments to various phone companies for the use of their T1 lines, etc. Approximately 15 to 20% of this fund is used to replace the equipment in the 49 separate PSAPs in Oregon. When the legislature adopted the present 75 cent per month tax for all such instruments, prepaid wireless services were not part of the business model utilized in the marketplace. What has occurred since is a significant increase in usage of this particular method of cell phone communication. Prepaid cell phone usage is now estimated to make up anywhere between 10% to in excess of 20% of all cell phone uses in Oregon. According to our estimates, the 911 program statewide could conceivably have between $3 to $6 million of 911 excise tax revenue per biennium that is not being collected. After this bill was produced, at our request, several of the cell phone carriers approached me with concerns about the language. The biggest concern was the provision that requires cell phone companies to collect the tax, as they do presently with the postpaid services. We asked the representatives of the companies to meet with us and attempt to find a solution that would be workable for all parties. The wireless carrier industry, who has representatives here today and will testify later, I'm sure, all indicated they preferred that the law require point-of-sale collection of the prepaid cell phone tax. That's not what the bill calls for. As you might suspect, if the law requires point-of-sale collection, we will then have other interest groups that will undoubtedly express their opinion to that process. The military department is concerned that by enacting a point-of-sale tax, that not only will we create some immediate pushback from business interests, but also we do not have a fiscal model from the Department of Revenue that we can bring to you today to discuss the costs of collecting this tax. With these difficulties in mind, is my hope that we can offer to you some potential courses of action that you can consider and then advise us on which of these, or perhaps some other course of action we have not considered, so we can work with the stakeholders to craft a workable solution. We have four basic options regarding this bill. Number one, the point-of-sale method. We envision any retailer who sells more than $1,000 a month of prepaid phones and minutes based on the retail price collecting and remitting the tax. Making use of the point-of-sale method would entail developing and putting in place the mechanism to collect the tax and remit the tax to the state by a retailer. If we adopt a point-of-sale method, which the carriers would prefer, the cost of collection and compliance is unknown. Based upon the Department of Revenue's efforts to gain compliance with the tobacco tax from the retailers in the state, they had to employ 8 FTE. I suggest that the number could be greater in order to gain compliance from the retailers, as this state has no sales tax. This would cause point-of-sale collection to be that much more difficult. Over time, I suspect, like Department of Revenue tax collection efforts on tobacco, the number of compliance officers would diminish. But I don't have any numbers to give you today. The wireless carriers provided great detail in recommending point-of-sale taxing in other states with sales tax. Perhaps they could provide instances where point-of-sale tax for prepaid was developed by states without a sales tax in place. We have not gotten that as yet. Second option would be tax the wholesaler. This would entail having any wholesale distributor that distributes prepaid phones and cards to any retailer for resale within the state. The distributor would then pay the tax based on a 1.5% of the wholesale price and remit the tax to the Department of Revenue. This tax would be passed along to the retailers for payments of the tax by the end user. As the tax would be both on phones and the minutes, the cards that are sold, the percentage method was developed. The 1.5% tax was arrived by dividing the current 75 cents by wireless industry estimates of the average monthly wireless phone bill. This approach is more manageable from the Department of Revenue standpoint, as they currently have a working relationship with the in-state wholesale distributors in regards to the tobacco tax. We also asked the wireless providers to provide us an estimate of the number of wholesalers they work with to distribute their phones and cards that allow someone to recharge the minutes on the prepaid phone. They responded that it was a difficult question to answer because the distribution models are so varied and complex. As the wireless providers themselves distribute their prepaid cards in bulk to retailers like Walmart, Target, Best Buy, etc., they are the wholesalers. As well, these retailers may also end up reselling these products to other distributors and wholesalers. We particularly see this possibility with Costco, for example. As such, they would be unsure who would be the actual wholesaler responsible for collection and payment of the tax, so it does have issues. Another option is amend the current bill to add a percentage of tax collected to the industry for additional costs incurred to collect the prepaid taxes. While the bill is written, has opposition from the wireless providers, we could offer an amendment that would allow some administrative fee support for collecting this tax. As I understand the system now, no wireless phone can be used without activation by the wireless carrier. At the time, it would seem to me that the tax could be applied at that time of activation. It would not matter where the phone was purchased. It would be the end user who would have to contact the carrier to have the phone account activated or to have the minutes added to the account to continue the service. The customer would have to provide the zip code where the phone would be enabled. If that zip code is in Oregon, then the tax would be applied to the carriers and remitted to the state. Carriers make the point that they have no idea where the phone minute cards may be sold and have no way of controlling or knowing where the phone or minute cards would be used. However, the carrier's spokesperson, in a reply to one of our questions, stated that, quote, the carrier does not know where the card is sold until the customer activates the card. By then, the money has already changed hands. As such, the carrier knows exactly where the customer activated the phone or the card, and if the location is in the state, then the tax could be applied. I think the industry will tell you that this will create significant burden on their present business model, by which if a small percentage of this revenue should be provided for the additional cost. We have not fully discussed this approach with the representatives of the industry since we last met, and I have given them my testimony this morning, and I suspect they will have some responses later or they have an opportunity to get it. The final option, the least desirable, is to put this option on the table, or put the bill on the table and not require the tax. This option essentially states that if you choose a certain business model for your personal cell phone use, you are exempt from supporting the emergency response system in Oregon. I don't think it's the right approach, but it is an approach. I wish today we could have come to you with a solution that only works with respect to the complexity of the tax collection system in Oregon, but also work with the industry to come up with a solution. But at this stage, we are unable to provide you that outcome. I would ask the committee to give us some direction on how you'd like us to proceed once you've had an opportunity to listen to the other interested parties. I think there's a way to tackle this issue and find a workable solution, but we don't have that for you today. So that concludes my testimony, and I'd be more than willing to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Questions for General Caldwell?
Yeah.
Representative Berger.
General, the bill is currently written. Which one of your methods is in the bill?
Madam Chairman,
Which one were you trying to get at? We won't ask technically if it gets you there, but which one were you?
What were you after?
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, number three, basically, I didn't really talk about that as much as I probably should have. The bill actually today is a mirror image of what has been done in Montana. Unfortunately, in Montana, what we've learned since we last met with the carriers is that even though the bill is almost word for word identical, only 10% of the total tracked phone prepaid cellular service is being collected. Also, Montana is in litigation with one of the major carriers, and they've been in litigation for 4, 5, 6 years. And that hasn't been resolved. So it doesn't seem that is a workable solution the way the bill is currently written, or we're just probably going to end up in an extended legal challenge that will do nothing other than cause lawyers to make a lot of money. So, again, we just after these reviews and after these discussions with the carriers, we just don't think it's a workable solution at this point.
What's in the current bill?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll find my list here. John Cray, Larry Hatch, Christina Squires. And for no other reason than that they came to me in this order, I'm going to call the public agencies first, and then we'll hear from the companies. And it doesn't matter to me who goes first. You're not a panel. I recognize that. It was for our convenience.
Good morning, co-chairs, co-vice chairs, representatives of the committee. My name is John Cray. I'm the Residential Service Protection Fund manager at the Public Utility Commission. Current statute requires landlines and wireless customers to pay the 911 tax for their access to emergency services. The Oregon Emergency Management is proposing Health Bill 2075 that requires fixed interconnected voice over internet protocol and prepaid telecommunication service providers to collect the 911 tax from their customers who also have access to emergency services. If Health Bill 2075 does not pass, customers, landline, and wireless will be required to continue paying for prepaid telecommunication service providers and fixed interconnected voice over internet protocol for their customers' access to emergency services. The PUC had a similar bill, Senate Bill 146, in which these providers will be required to collect the Residential Service Protection Fund surcharge for their customers' access to the telecommunication relay service. The PUC, Oregon Emergency Management and Department of Revenue, the agency that collects the 911 tax, all work together to develop these bills. The PUC believe that this is a fair and equitable measure in which all customers, not just landline and wireless customers who have access to emergency services, pay the 911 tax. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Cray? Go ahead.
Good morning, co-chairs Barnhart and Berger, committee members. I'm Larry Hatch. I'm here representing the Oregon APCO NENA, the 911 organizations across the state, and the board of directors from Washington County 911. I'm here today in support of House Bill 2075. Our membership believes this brings equity in the collection of the 911 telephone tax. Support of the 911 system in the state of Oregon began with standard wireline telephones in 1981. The technology has changed over the years with the addition of cellular phones and voice over internet protocol. As these various technologies came into the state, they participated in our 911 program by collecting the tax on the monthly phone bills. Now we have a hybrid in the cellular world, prepaid wireless services. Customers choose to purchase a phone with a block of minutes and not be tied to a monthly contract. Recent articles have documented the shift in the market, and it will likely continue as customers choose to avoid early cancellation fees and save money on services, only paying for those they use. In the fourth quarter of 2009, it was reported that 20% of wireless customers used prepaid wireless services, which was a 2% increase over the previous quarter. This bill corrects this inequity and requires prepaid wireless customers to support our program. Colorado, Utah, Texas, Oklahoma, Mississippi, and Louisiana have passed similar legislation to bring prepaid wireless in line with other wireless providers. Public safety organizations from across the state support House Bill 2075, and those letters are attached to my written testimony. The membership of Oregon APCO NENA urges your support of House Bill 2075. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Special districts.
Good morning, Co-Chairs Barnhart and Berger. For the record, Hasina Squires on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Our membership consists of approximately 950 special service districts that provide service throughout the state of Oregon. Our largest group of members are rural fire protection districts. We do have some 911 special districts that also belong to our association. Our fire districts, our special districts, don't receive the city-county revenue distribution, that 60.5% that General Caldwell referenced that's split out of that 911 tax. So our fire entities pay user fees to agencies like Mr. Hatch's Washington County Consolidated Agency. So when the full tax is not collected, our user agencies are then saddled with additional user fees to pay for the services of 911 entities. Rather than belabor all of my testimony, I'll just summarize a few items. It is very clear that prepaid phone service is booming in the United States. Within the past year, Consumers definitely seem to be abandoning their contract-based plans, and that is really the main consumer trend for why people are abandoning the four main entities, Verizon Wireless, AT&T, T-Mobile, and Sprint, because consumers are annoyed and irritated with the large contracts. I happen to use Sprint, and I love my Sprint service, and I will continue to use it, and I don't need, I'm not upset about the contract, but many consumers are irritated that they cannot get out of the contract, and when they do get the opportunity to get out of whatever contract they have, they will switch to a prepaid phone service. In 2009, smaller prepaid carriers like Metro PCS saw a large swell in subscriber additions, about 74% in 2009. In the fourth quarter of 2009, Sprint Nextel reported losing 1.3 million customers to prepaid, and that story just that trend kind of continues. A couple of recent surveys that have been conducted by the New Millennium Research Council. In 2009, there were 17% of Americans that had switched from contract plans to prepaid plans, and the most recent survey that they conducted indicates that one in five cell phone consumers with contract-based services is likely to change and switch in early 2011. So this is an issue that, if we don't address it this session, definitely will be back next session if we can't find some sort of agreement, because it is definitely a trend that is going to continue to expand in the United States. There are two methods in the piece of legislation that was put forward by the military department. One of those pieces, one of those options, and it was optional, two different types of ways that wireless carriers could, or prepaid phones could be, tax could be collected. One would be on a monthly basis, the prepaid service provider would collect an amount equal to 75 cents at the end of the month. So if the meaning is, if you have minutes and you have money in your account at the end of the month, they take 75 cents. For me as a layperson, I find that really difficult to understand why that tax can't just be deducted and taken out of that account if you have the minutes. I doubt consumers would be gaming the system to deplete all of their minutes to avoid the 75-cent tax at the end of the month. The other method is a little more complicated, but it is one that is being used in Tennessee that is more complicated, but is something that else that has been used in the United States. Again, litigation is prevalent, so however the legislature chooses to act on this, it should act very cautiously. With that, I will answer any questions and express our support for the concepts contained, and how that tax gets collected will be up to policymakers.
Thank you. Questions? And I have a couple, and I may want to include Mr. Cray in the questions, because I'm not certain who can answer them. It appears to me that we haven't talked today about voice over internet protocol. We've been talking about prepaid phones, but the bill includes the language having to do with the internet. Now, I know the other day I logged on to my Gmail account and a little box came up saying, make phone calls over your Gmail account, it's easy. Is that voice over internet protocol? And if this bill were to pass, would Google have to pay this tax? Or does anybody know? Please.
Mr. Chair, co-chair, members of the committee, with respect to Google, no, because that, to me, my understanding, that would be a nomadic voice over internet protocol type service.
Thank you. Yes, I do recall that one of the things they said in the little box was, you can't use this for 911 service, which, of course, is what we're trying to pay for with this tax. Have I got that part right?
Could you repeat the question again, please, Mr.
Yes.
Chair?
My recollection is that in that little box I was describing on my Gmail account, one of the notes said that there was no 911 service with this phone system. And that, of course, would exclude it from what we spend the money on, I think.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. So if I were running a voice over internet protocol system, the way to avoid paying this tax would be simply to warned people that they could not use it for emergency calls to 911.
Mr. Chair, that's my understanding.
Thank you. Yes, please.
Chair Barnhart, committee members, what we experienced early on in the industry when VOIP first came in was, you know, Vonage and folks like that. Vonage was a true partner with us, and they came in wanting to be part of the Oregon 911 program, paying the tax. They did start off, however, early on with that same little box popping up. Now you probably see commercials all the time about Magic Jack, only pay $1.95 a month for phone service. I don't have any experience with those folks. I'm concerned about, I'm hoping that they have a little box pop up for them, but there's a lot of different things out there right now that it's really hard for us in the industry to keep track of.
Co-chairs Barnhart and Berger, members of the committee, Hastings Squires, on behalf of the Special Districts Association. Page 1 at the bottom of the bill, page 1, line 30, and the top of page 2 describes what fixed internet voice over internet protocol. It means a telecommunication service that utilizes an internet protocol to enable a customer to participate in real-time two-way voice communication. That's very broadly written, and I think you will hear some testimony from Comcast about that language.
Thank you. I suspect we will, especially now that you've told them about it. Thank
they,
you.
They know. Trust me. They already know.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious. There's been an explosion of these devices, so one would think there would be a much higher amount of money collected. I know in my family we seem to have 40 phones for every child. The question is, where we haven't talked at all about the total amount being collected. Has there been some sort of an increase in the demand upon 911 services concurrent with the increase in number of devices out there, or is that even coming into this conversation?
Co-chairs Barnhart, Co-chair Berger, members of the committee, that's an excellent question, Representative Bench. I'll answer it from the perspective of revenue collection being static. So one would assume that if a whole bunch of customers, wireless customers now, were switching immediately to prepaid phones, and prepaid phones aren't paying the tax, that the revenues would be declining by at least 5%, 10%, 15%, whatever the number is. It's somewhere between nationwide 10% and 20%. That is not happening in Oregon yet. So we're not seeing that decrease in revenue collection. It's holding pretty steady, about $10 million a quarter in total revenues. But the call volume is increasing, and Mr. Hatch can address that. Not at the same rate. The revenues are not keeping up at the same rate as the call volume coming in.
I have a follow-up, but
yes.
I'd like to hear the answer first and the follow-up or the additional explanation.
Sure, Chair, Co-Chairs Barnhart and Berger, Representative Bentz. We're seeing what Hasina reported at the local level as far as the static revenue coming into the budget as our costs increase about anywhere from 4% to 5% a year. The revenue that we get from the tax has stayed static, which means that our fire departments and police departments are having to pick up the extra. As far as call volume, we are seeing incremental increases in our call volume each year.
Follow up. Yes, please. Uh-huh.
This actually goes to the point of today, which appears to be an equity issue as opposed to the volume of money collected, at least for the moment, issue. And I'm just curious of your thinking about what the PUC has decided or suggested, which I think is what you were handed earlier. Do you have a solution that you are particularly attracted to in this, in what we're looking at? Do you guys have a solution that you like of those that which you are looking at?
Co-chairs Barnhart and Berger, members of the committee, I can tell you what we don't like. We don't like point of sale, which is what the industry would like. Point of sale is going to cost more to collect than the amount of money that we will get. So it's probably a zero-sum or losing proposition to get every mom-and-pop shop, Plaid Pantry, Best Buy, every single retailer in the state that's able to sell prepaid phones, having Department of Revenue set up to audit prepaid phones that won't have the tobacco stamp on them in advance.
There's a solution.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
Again, I would just say that I'm not an expert in how the collection method would work. I know that it is working point of sale in many of the other states, and that's because they have sales tax. In my mind, I don't comprehend why it is a person who has 75 cents left in their prepaid phone plan that cannot be remitted.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a series of questions, but one, first off, thank you, Mr. Hatch, for every time I call you answer. I appreciate that. It's very important. But on the voiceover IP, a thought that occurred to me, and I don't know if it's a non-issue, isn't there currently a federal moratorium on new internet taxes? And would this fall into that moratorium?
Co-Chair Barnhart and Berger, Representative Eric Brewer, I'm not aware of that. Right now, as I say, you know, the Verizon, Fios, Comcast, Vonage, they're all participating here in Oregon.
Is it voluntary, do you know, or is statutorily required?
No, our law is currently written, they felt that it required them to pay, and they stood up.
Okay. Thank you. Piggybacking on what Representative Bentz mentioned as I was hearing testimony, I'm not sure if this is more about getting more money or more fairness in the users of the system. And when you mentioned that revenues are static and calls are going up, well, that leads to a potential problem down the road. But you're also saying that there's a shift monthly service to the prepaid service and users. But is there an overall growth as well in either sector in the total usage of cell phones? Do we have an overall growth in cell phones, whether it's prepaid or monthly service? And is that growth outpacing the growth in call usage for 911s to the center?
Co-chairs Berger and Barnhart, Representative Eric Brewer, yes, we're seeing our call volume is regularly now more cellular phones than wireline or VoIP phones in the 60% range of our total 911 calls.
But is follow-up, Mr.
Please,
Chair.
Yes.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
But the question is there an overall growth in cell phones, regardless of which methodology of arrangement they have? And the reason why I'm speaking to this is that what the bill doesn't contemplate is if we have an overall growth in phones, the assessment continuing on all cell phones regardless of the need. So if we add the prepaid, should we have a decrease in the active services to equal, if it, you know, we don't want to overtax. So I don't know if you, maybe some of the industry has some statistics too on overall phone growth.
Co-chairs Berger and Barnhart, Representative Eric Brewer, I can only speak from what I see in my community, and that is probably 30% of the population has abandoned wireline phones altogether and shifted to wireless phones.
Okay.
Please.
And one question on a different area. Provider definition, and I don't know if you're the right folks for this. But the definition of provider in here speaks of utility or other vendor or supplier of telecommunication services or equipment, and the provider is the one who has the responsibility for the first collection. That seems overly broad, so it could be the provider of the minutes or the phone itself or the sale of the minutes, or it kind of makes anybody in the loop in the supply chain responsible for collection.
Co-chairs Barnhart and Berger, Representative Eric Brewer, I think that the key there is that the provider means that those, as you have stipulated, that provides telecommunications service with access to the 911 emergency reporting system. That's sort of the key, that you're not just a middleman. You're providing the service that provides you access. So when we originally crafted this piece of legislation, when it was originally crafted in 1981, it was meant to get at anyone who has the ability to access the 911 service system.
comment, and then I'll be done. It also says, or equipment. And so that maybe needs to be tightened up. And I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions for this panel? Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. And I'm also very pleased that when I call, you answer. Laura Wolf, Christy Wild, Ted. Ted, Canby Fire District.
Coons.
Coons. Okay. You write reports by hand, don't you? Please.
Co-chairs Barnhart and Berger, members of the committee. Good morning. I'm Laura Wolf with the City of Portland's Bureau of Emergency Communications. I'm here today in support of House Bill 2075. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you this morning. BOA is responsible for all of the call answering and dispatch for all of Multnomah County and the 725,000 residents. On average, we take about 3,000 calls a day, or over 1 million estimates. About 70% of those calls that we take are wireless calls. And if you go with the market trend, 20%, that's a pretty significant amount of prepaid wireless calls that come into our center every day. On average, our revenue that we receive from the distribution is about 70% of our annual operating budget comes from the revenue, from the telephone tax revenue. I won't belabor and go over what everybody else has said already, but one of the concerns for us is that in today's world, Oregon 911 centers are facing challenges attempting to catch up to the rapidly changing technology. The various ways in which to access 911 either today or in the future all present their own unique set of issues. VoIP, PDAs, pagers, et cetera, with the expectation that folks who are using them can access 911 services, and today they can't. In order to maintain that and to keep up with that technology, we need to make sure that we have that revenue stream coming in. And by collecting the tax from prepaid wireless, it will help continue funding the implementation and support the necessary equipment required to perform those essential tasks. The City of Portland joins Oregon APCONINA and the public safety answering points throughout Oregon in support of legislation to require the prepaid wireless phone industry to support the Oregon 911 program. Thank you for your time, and I'll answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Let's go ahead with Christy. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Chair Barnhart, Chair Berger, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christy Wild. I'm with Central Lane Communications, which is administered by the Eugene Police Department. The City of Eugene supports the passage of House Bill 2075, which would ensure that 911 excise tax is collected from all devices capable of dialing 911, including prepaid. Our regional center, Central Lane Communications, serves over 300,000 citizens. Our local experience has been validating what the national surveys have said, and that with the wireless usage trends. In watching our phone line statistics over the past 2.5 years, it's been very clear that wireless usage has risen to the point where it's averaging at least 60% of all incoming 911 calls every month. So
I'm sorry, could you repeat that sentence again?
What we have observed over the past 2.5 years is that the source of our incoming 911 calls has shifted so that more than 60% of the incoming calls are coming from wireless devices. Sorry.
Thank you. No, I think you said it right the first time.
Okay.
But I was, I just didn't get it. That's
okay.
All.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. We've made changes in our phone system and staffing to better handle those calls, and we understand that wireless service is rapidly replacing wireline home phones of the past. We do not expect anymore that surges of 911 calls into our center are coming from a flurry of people observing the same traffic accident. So we've made adjustments. The 911 excise tax is critical to supporting the service in our area and across the state. We need a system that spreads those costs fairly amongst the users of the service. As a greater number, as you've heard, of citizens are choosing to go wireless for all telephone service, or and are either considering or choosing prepaid devices, Our ability to sustain access to critical emergency services by dialing 911 is at risk. It is both reasonable and equitable in these times of increased expectations for 911 service, including the growing request that we be able to take calls from text phones, accept video and information from automatic crash notification in people's cars, that we need to make sure the system is supported by the devices that are accessing the service. The City of Eugene asks for your support in passing House Bill 2075. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much. Ed.
Good morning. Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, members of the committee. My name is Ted Coons. I'm the Fire Chief and Chief Executive Officer of the Canby Fire District. I'm also a past President of the Oregon Fire Chiefs, and I have served on the State 911 Advisory Committee in the past. I don't want to repeat anything anybody said, so I'm going to kind of probably jump around here a little bit. The biggest concern to the fire chiefs of the state is the issue which Hasina Squires referred to earlier. We don't, in fire districts, we don't receive any 911 revenue. That goes to the cities, it goes to the PSAPs and the counties. For us, the benefit that we receive is that when those monies are contributed to the PSAPs, they help support that system and they keep our user fees down. Without these revenues, service levels continue to have to rise to meet the demand. That means user fees for districts such as mine and the other fire districts within the state of Oregon are going to have to go up to support that. We view this as an issue of restoration of lost revenue. It's an opportunity to maintain those services. As you've heard, 60% plus is coming from wireless devices now. Whether it be a house fire, we see that all the time, auto accident, medical condition, whatever else, most of those calls now are coming in by wireless devices. So on behalf of the Oregon Fire Chiefs, myself as the Fire Chief of the Canby Fire District, we urge your support of 2075 to maintain the services that we need to provide to our communities. And I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Mark Adams, Bob Livingston.
Chairs, Barnhart, Berger, Committee, excuse my voice this morning. I woke up with a new one. I am Mark Adams. I'm a Chief of Police in Kaiser, Oregon, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police. The OACP strongly supports passage of House Bill 2075. Our officers, our departments across the state, we do the best, we pledge to do the best we can with the revenue provided. The revenue to support our 911 systems is not getting the job done. As you've heard repeatedly today, that the cell phone impact is just huge. The old days when there was an accident or a need, somebody hollered, call 911, and somebody went and found a phone and called it. Today they get 20 calls on the same thing because everybody has cell phones. As we've seen the technology develop over the years for our emergency communications, the cost has far outpaced the revenue. As that happens in my department and all departments, we watch every year our operations, our funding for police officers slowly sliding across the table to pay more and more for our communications. With the prepaid phones paying no tax through this loophole, there's $6 million or so not being collected that could help provide the revenue to help us provide the public safety service necessary. The members of OACP encourage you to pass House Bill 2075. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, Chair Berger, members of the committee, for the record, Bob Livingston, representing the Oregon State Firefighters Council. And as I sat in the back of the room trying to figure out what perspective I could give to you on this issue, I think I'm going to give you a boots on the ground. As a veteran of the fire service for over 20 years, as Mr. Hatch noted, you know, we have seen a paradigm shift. It used to be that you'd have to run down to somebody that may have had a phone, and even earlier in the history of the fire service, you know, you'd see the fire chief with the megaphone and the bell would go off. The reality of it is we're in the 21st century. I, like Representative Bentz, have two kids at home that have cell phones. Their they're texting back and forth, all these things, there's been a change. I think the expectation here in Oregon is that we have an excellent 911 system, but the fact remains that now over 15% of the market is a prepaid cellular market. Clearly, I think we owe it not only to our first responders. Later today, I will certainly be going back to my duties, riding around on a fire engine. And I can tell you from a boots on the ground perspective that we rely extremely every day on the importance of the information that we get from 911. And I applaud the cellular companies. They have helped to improve the technology. Not only are we getting calls earlier for service, we're getting more accurate information via these cellular phones. But as our technology changes here in Oregon, if we're going to have the spirit of Oregon on our birthday and a long line of stepping up to the plate, I think there needs to be a recognition that we have to be able to change with technology. Certainly, I think that your police officers and firefighters that are out doing this job day to day in conjunction with the dispatchers that provide us with the information do the best that we can. But ultimately, I think we have a policy, a discussion, and a decision that needs to be made. I think most people in Oregon understand the importance of 911. I think they've came to expect a certain level of service from 911, and the fact still remained, if it's not solved today, that we have a growing population of our cellular and our ability to use 911 that is being paid by prepaid, that again is not paying into the system. And so while this is a difficult issue, we can sit here and, you know, what if this from a legal standpoint, we can look at the difficulties of this. Clearly, I think point of sales, I'll be blunt, I think point of sales is a non-starter for many in this body by the fact that that's way too close to a sales tax. And so as someone who relies on 911 to do my job, to protect our members, and ultimately, more importantly, so that we can serve the citizens of Oregon, I would ask that this committee solve this problem. Let's address this before it becomes a crisis. While certainly Ms. Squire stated that, you know, we'll be back next session, I think, you know, we've talked a lot about the working together as a policy body and the people that are involved in the policy body. This is an issue, I think, is a seminal moment that we can step up and solve this, and I hope that the cellular providers will help provide that solution in the context of what we're trying to do, because ultimately this is an important issue for Oregonians, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Yes, please, Representative Air Brewer.
Thank you. This is more of a policy question, but as 911 first responders that you are, and this is also from my perspective, I ask because it's a trust issue with citizens. Last year, the 911 fund was swept into the general into our operating budget as a state. So when we ask more taxpayers to pay us a fee for something specific, how do you feel about the 911 fund getting swept and taken out, and when it's approximately a third of what you're saying is not being collected currently?
Chair Barnhart, Chair Berger, Representative Arbor, are you speaking to the fact of the interest that's being swept? Is that what you're...
The $2 million plus that was kind of taken.
Well, it just seems like that's another $2 million that's... folks are paying in expecting it to go to one place, and it's not. It's going to the general fund. And again, I think that's something that should be looked at. I think it's a different bill that would... put that into an all-in-one fund, but that's another piece of the tax that's not making it to where it needs to go.
If I may, on that, Chair Barnhart, Chair Berger, Representative Ira Brewer, our organization doesn't like it. Sweeps of funds that are dedicated to 911. Clearly, while there's lots of difficult policy decisions that you all as a body are going to make, I think it is something that you have to be extremely careful with, particularly in these tough, difficult times with the deficits that we're seeing and the shortfalls at the state government level. But I will just suggest this, that the everything is local, and 911 taxes go to local services, whether it be police or fire. And so I think be extremely careful, and I think you'll probably see pieces of legislation that would encourage you not to make sweeps as it relates to whether it's 911 funds, whether it's other funds that really help emergency services at the local level.
Thank you. Just a quick comment on that issue. I was here in 2002 when we had five special sessions and we're scraping the barrels all over and the backs of the cupboards and everything to find the money to try to balance the budget. And, of course, last year was a similar, although probably less dramatic, situation. I've always opposed sweeping these funds or funds from any other specialized account because I think it's really dishonest in the way in which you asked for the money in the first place. I do understand that when the choice is huge cuts in really basic services, the temptation is huge to do it. But the legislature seems to have succumbed to that temptation, regardless of who was in control. Whenever we've had a recession, so. I think, Representative Eric Brewer, you've raised a very good point, and it's something we should really pay attention to. Representative Juan.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I mean, this dovetails on an issue that I've had for many years now in the state of Oregon, which is a kind of a breach of trust between our neighbors and the government. And when we do things like ask for an increased fee or expand the scope of a fee such as this, and then we promise the voters, our neighbors, that these funds will be dedicated for a specific person or purpose, then it really erodes that trust in a fundamental way when we sweep them for other things. And so I appreciate you guys coming forward with this particular bill. This is important. And one of the keys for me is how we make sure that if we do something like this to secure funding for 911 service, that it doesn't become a free-for-all every time we have an economic downturn. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, please.
Chair Barnhart, Chair Berger, while there wasn't a question in that, one of the things that I would suggest, too, is that what we're really asking for is that a change in the marketplace, and we have a large sector of the marketplace that's not paying into this. And while I'm certainly not a law enforcement expert, this is anecdotal, and hopefully maybe one of my partners in law enforcement, I don't want to paint a wide brush on this because certainly I think there's a place for prepaid cellular phones for a whole cadre of people that need to have access to telephones and cellular usage. But let's not forget that prepaid cellulars are also a tool of choice by many of the people that cause Chief Adams and his folks a lot of problems. And my point, while we can laugh at that, my point is, though, if you were to do a study, and it'd be anecdotal, disproportionately, I think some of the activities that cause services from 911 to be enacted potentially is probably a higher portion on these prepaid cellulars, particularly on the criminal side. And while I want to be careful to paint the broad brush, again, that's another policy issue that I think we should not lose sight of. Thank you.
You weren't going to say that, Chief Adams, but you certainly were smiling while he said it.
That's correct, sir.
Thank you. The only additional comment I have is that it appears to me, based on the testimony we've heard so far, that these revenues are either needed now or will very soon be needed simply to operate the system. We won't be facing as much of the issues that Representative Eric Brewer and Representative Wand talked about because the money will already be spent in the 911 system. I'm getting a head nod. Is that? Yeah, I think you're agreeing with me.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Let's go on. T-Mobile, AT&T, and Sprint. And Mr. Wolf from the Oregon Telecommunications Association is next on. On tap. Yes, sir. Gentlemen.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Russell Sarazin. I work for T-Mobile USA. We support the objective of this bill. So we strongly support the opportunity for our customers, whether they're prepaid or postpaid, to be contributing to the 911 fund. We're proud partners with public safety. We've spent hundreds of millions of dollars in our network, making sure that you can be located when you are calling 911. That's regardless of whether you're using a prepaid, obviously, or a postpaid telephone. In this dilemma, we need to reach a solution that's equitable so that one customer isn't paying a tax and another isn't. We need to reach a solution that's efficient for the state so that we're not losing money in administrative costs. We need to have something that's transparent to everybody so that there's not litigation, ongoing auditing, those types of outcomes, and certainty so that budgets can be set. We've been working on this issue for many years. This is not something that's new. It may be new here in the state of Oregon, but it's not new for the wireless industry or public safety. We have been working with the national chapters of APCO and NINA, our industry association, retailers, and we've come up with a national solution, which is the point-of-sale model, which you've heard discussed today. And unfortunately, there's not been a lot of support here, but we believe that it is the right solution. It's been adopted in 13 states. It's being considered in another 17 states this year. In our mind, any other solution other than a point-of-sale model will not accomplish the goals that I set forth here before. I can go into a lot of details as to why. Just for one example, what was brought up here today was perhaps we could take minutes out of somebody's account. One of the largest areas of growth in prepaid has been unlimited prepaid phones. So you spend $50, $30, and you get unlimited access to the network for a month. You can't take anything of value from a customer that has purchased an unlimited account. So the company will end up paying that tax on behalf of the customer. And again, if the goal is to create equity so that you don't have one customer buying a certain service to evade a particular tax, we need to get this done when the money changes hands at the point of sale. Another issue is a company like T-Mobile. We've made a corporate decision that says if you're going to buy 100 minutes or if you're going to buy 500 minutes, you're going to get 100 minutes. We're not going to start taking minutes away from your account. We don't feel like that's good business. Perhaps other companies might, and that's the competitive nature of our industry. We would end up paying that tax on behalf of the customer if that were the solution. There's been also some comparison to Montana. The statute that I've seen out of Montana is not a 911 statute that this was based on, and I could be wrong about that, and I know that some of the folks here in the room may be able to correct me, but that was another tax altogether. T-Mobile doesn't do business in Montana, so we don't have the issues of compliance there, so I can't speak to that. Perhaps some of my colleagues can. But I do know that there is litigation ongoing. Ultimately, we look forward to reaching a solution with public safety, with the Department of Revenue, with the PUC. We are encouraged by the dialogue that's been ongoing, and we hope we have the opportunity to continue this process, move it forward, and come up with a good solution for the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you. Co-Chair Barnhart and Co-Chair Berger are members of the committee. My name is Adam Grisbicki. I'm the president for AT&T in Oregon, based in Portland. And I don't have any prepared comments for today, simply because it'd be fairly redundant of what was just shared to you by Mr. Sarazin here from T-Mobile. The wireless industry is in cohesion on this in terms of the way that we look at this, the way that we look at this issue. And I just want to reiterate that you know, obviously we're national providers. We're providing in 51 states, including the District of Columbia. We've looked across the states as the best way of collecting this tax. You know, there's a lot of discussion in the room today about the need for additional monies, the need for an equitable manner to pay into the 911 system, what the PSAPs are facing, what the local law enforcement or fire are facing. We couldn't agree more. I think what we're down to now is just the approach and the ways and means that we go about and do this. And being that national provider, that is the reason we took this to NCSL. We looked at the model to find out what would work best. We've dealt with legal issues. We've dealt with efficiency issues. We've dealt with opposition, you know, from each one of the different facets that are outlined to you. The point of sale model is the most recognizable and probably the best type of skeletal system to kind of move going forward. As we drafted in NCSL, that type of point-of-sale model approach. I just want to reiterate, that's the only model that's been adopted by the states since the passage of that. Again, 13 states have moved towards that. Many more are currently, you know, looking at that point-of-sale model. And you look at the Oregon landscape, too. The larger retailers that are selling some of these prepaid services make up about 80% of that market share. The retailers ourselves, it's not an obligation we're trying to pass on someone else. We're a retailer ourselves. So any of those obligations at point of sale would apply to AT&T and T-Mobile and the other wireless stores that are selling these services like we do. We make up about 10% of that market. So as General Caldwell said earlier, if there's an exception to cut, you know, a smaller retailer out of that picture, that's your decision to do. But you're still, at the very least, capturing 90% of the market from retailers who are already collecting this in other states. This isn't a new approach that's going to be, you know, unknown as to, you know, how about the means of going about doing this. That those systems and those accesses are already in place. All we have to do is replicate that process here in Oregon. And some of the other things that were discussed today, kind of that decrement approach that Mr. Sarazin just mentioned, that was mentioned earlier about taking money out of someone's account, you know, at the end of the month, to suggest there's not game playing going on potentially with that kind of scenario, I don't think is a fair or accurate representation of what could happen. If folks know they're going to be taxed, of course there are going to be folks that want to avoid that tax. When you look at a total market share that General Caldwell talked to you about of about $3 to $6 million and be able to accurately capture 90% of that revenue in a pretty painless way of doing that at a point of sale approach, I think that's going to actually make the most bang for your buck here in the state of Oregon, and I think it's the most efficient way and means of going about doing this. Thank you.
Thank you.
For the record, I'm Brian DeLeishman. I'm here representing Sprint Nextel. Quick disclaimer, you all know that I also represent the Troopers Association in the state as well as the Oregon Council of Police Associations. Let me say right up front that none of those associations or Sprint Nextel believes that there's a dispute over that everyone who has access to 911 should be paying into the system. That is not the issue. The issue, of course, that you now have heard is how do you collect that amount? You've talked, some testimony about adoption of the NCSL model. You've heard that 13 states have already done it. 17 states are in the process of looking at that as a potential model. You've also heard that between 70% and 80% of the transactions happen at the large retail. That's the Walmarts, the Targets, the Radio Shacks, and then our individual stores. There's the ability to collect at that, whether there is a general sales tax in the state of Oregon or not. Let's not fool ourselves, however, in Oregon. We do have sales taxes on certain things. We have taxes on tires. We have taxes on liquor. We have taxes on tobacco. The 75 cents itself on hardwire or non-prepaid wireless is really a sales tax. So to say that we don't have a sales tax in Oregon, we already have a model for a sales tax in Oregon. However, it's not a general sales tax. Let me leave you with one last thought. The proposal, the way the bill is put in front of you right now, may be the simplest. But for us, putting the burden on us to pay the fee when the subscriber pays the fees when it's hardwire and it's already monthly service is not acceptable. You expect the subscriber to pay in all the other cases except for in this case with the prepaid wireless. And we would suggest again that the model that has been adopted in 13 other states is the way to go. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Berger.
Thank you. Mr. Sarazin, I presume you're from out of state.
Yes, I am.
But Mr. Graybecky, you indicated you live in Portland.
Correct.
And I know where you live, Brian. I don't think any of you are suggesting putting a stamp on phones like we do cigarettes, or we could collect all phones at the border and sell them as a wholesale them ourselves as a state, which we do for liquor. I don't know what we do with tires, but the fact of the matter is we aren't other states. We don't even look remotely like other states when it comes to the point of sale system. Therefore, we have a real problem here. I think we're all agreed that there's a real need to come to some other solution. And so I guess I'm just asking you to come to the table and realize this isn't some other state. And if the point of sale system costs us more to, you know, to deliver than collect, then it just simply isn't going to work. And so we need to look beyond. I heard you all sit up here and say, and nod, need to do it, let's do it like every other state. We aren't every other state, gentlemen, so we need to look beyond that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, if I could respond to that. A state like Washington, next door, is considering this legislation this year. If it were to pass, and if Oregon were to impose, let's just say we did decrementing, which means you take minutes out of somebody's account and use that somehow to account for the charge, you would have two potential very real scenarios where you would either have somebody paying the tax twice or not paying the tax at all. You would have somebody here in Oregon with an Oregon phone number who goes across the state and buys minutes in Vancouver. And at that point, they would pay a tax on that at Radio Shack or wherever they might purchase that. And they activate it because they're driving up north. And when they activate it and they say, what's your area code or what's your zip code or what some sort of location identifier for them, state of Oregon, it gets activated. And that customer would then pay an Oregon tax, somehow get decremented out of their minutes or whatnot. The opposite would happen if somebody came from Washington, came to Oregon, purchased the card. There is no point of sale. They go back, and they would never pay that tax because it's not any sort of a decrementing. It's not an unrealistic scenario. We have many jurisdictions around the country, obviously. What we're hoping to accomplish is a national pattern where every individual, regardless if they're paying for their phone via prepaid or a postpaid plan, is going to contribute to the 911 systems around this country.
Yeah, I get the problem. I just haven't heard the solution yet from you, or that you're ever going to move off point of sale. Enough said.
I have a suggestion. We haven't heard from the department today, and I'm not going to put them on the spot. But it is clear to me from the testimony we have heard that the Department of Revenue thinks that this is going to be an expensive collection effort. You say that it isn't. I mean, essentially, that's what the three of you have said. I think it's clear that we are all in agreement that something needs to be done to even the playing field and to make certain that there are sufficient funds in the 911 system to keep it solvent and to keep it functioning so that that phone call gets answered. I would like very much for you to sit down with the department, probably with some other people in a work group, and convince them that what you're saying is the correct response, the correct answer, and demonstrate how this tax can be collected for no or very, very small cost on the part of the department, which is essentially, I think, what you're saying. Now, if you have evidence from other states that are doing this, that probably wouldn't be too difficult to do. And you can show them how they would go about collecting it and therefore, in part, how we would write amendments to this bill. I think the question I have at this now, I want to know whether that's something that you are thinking about doing and whether that's an approach that makes sense or whether we ought to talk about doing something else to get this bill into shape that the legislature can pass it.
Mr. Co-Chair, we have participated to this point in the discussions with the military department, the Office of Emergency Management, as well as the Department of Revenue and the right. PUC, well, and we'll continue to do so.
Thank you. There still does seem to be a very substantial disagreement, based on what you said and what we heard earlier, between those who think that this tax is pretty clear, pretty obvious, it's going to be collected without much overhead, and those who say, no, we're going to spend more money than the tax will bring in. I don't know what the real facts are, but I suspect that we're probably going to go our own way. At least there's a real possibility that we're going to go our own way, unless you can demonstrate to the department that they can collect this tax without spending a lot of money doing it, using the methods that you propose.
Mr. Co-Chair, if I may reply.
Please.
The major points are retailers that sell these minutes, and we mentioned them, the Walmarts, the Radio Shacks, already have national systems to collect this, whether it's a sales tax or a non-sales tax. So we believe that you'll be able to collect between 70 and, as Adam said, 90% of the revenue with very little effort out of the big three or four that sell these minutes. The complexity that has been brought up is the Ma and Pop store, the other 10 to 15 to 20%, and how much effort you want to put into trying to collect that if there's not, I guess, compliance, voluntary compliance by those. So we believe with very little expense that you'll be able to collect the between 80 and 90% from the major retailers by point of sale.
Thank you. Representative Wong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to echo what the co-chair said about finding a creative, maybe uniquely Oregon solution. And although this isn't a 30% general sales tax on food, I will tell you that my neighbors didn't vote for me to come to Salem representing them with the idea that I would vote for a sales tax. And this really strikes me as a sales tax. if it looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. So I'm asking you to get creative, work with us, find a way to do it that isn't a sales tax, because I'm only one of 60, but I won't vote for a sales tax.
Thank you. One last question, and that has to do with the 13 and 17 that we keep hearing. How many of those states are states that currently collect the general sales tax?
All of them.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Wolf. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard this morning on this bill who didn't get signed up? Thank you. Mr. Wolf, go ahead.
Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Brant Wolf. I represent the Oregon Telecommunications Association. I represent that part of the industry that supports House Bill 2075 fully and would ask you to support it with whatever amendments General Caldwell feels appropriate. I don't want to be late.
General, you have a blank check. Please, go ahead.
In this regard, he does, in my opinion. You've heard about it already. It's a matter of equity for us. Our members collect this fee. We remit it. We've been doing so for 30 years. I can assure you when it was first initially started, we didn't want to do it. Nobody likes to collect fees and taxes from their customers, but we do it. To the extent that landlines are diminishing, and it's with a heavy heart that I have to say that they are, it's a smaller and smaller pool of people supporting something that everybody gets to use, and that's just not fair. It's not right, and it should change. And this bill presents an excellent opportunity for the legislature to change that situation. And I know Hasina said this before in previous testimony, but the decision to do this has already been made. It was made years ago, and the industry has changed now, and the law should change to keep up with the times. And that's what this is about, and we support the bill, and we urge you to pass it at the appropriate time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for Brent? Thank you, sir. We appreciate your testimony. Anything further on the House Bill 2075 today? I think it goes without saying, I hope that we're going to need a work group on the bill. Madam Co-Chair?
Well, thoughts? I was going to suggest if there... there is some sort of a work group ongoing. I don't know if we want to augment that with we need to do something this session,
right,
Mr. Chair, and I think that we need to somehow light a fire under this process.
Well, we need to add at least one legislator to the work group, don't you think?
Yes, and I, yes.
What do you have?
I am not.
I don't see anybody leaping with a suggestion. Well, I think what we better do is you and I better sit down and we'll pick someone.
We will find a volunteer.
We will find a volunteer, and they will sit down with the good general and the department and the industry. And maybe Walmart and some of the others, and we'll figure this out. But I agree, Madam Co-Chair, that this is an issue that we very much need to get done this session. Anything else? We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2075. Anything else to come before the committee today? Yes, Representative Bailey.
May I just make a quick comment, completely tangential to this discussion, and say that I've been watching the sign interpreters here out of the corner of my eye, and yep. These are extremely technical and complicated subjects that we've been discussing. It's hard enough for me to just understand and listening to the testimony, much less having to understand it and translate it. I've been very impressed watching them work.
And,
yes, thank you. Yeah.
And as a result, Mr. Cray understands what we're doing here. Thank you. And thank you, Representative Bailey. We appreciate that closing remark. And with that, the committee is adjourned.